We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Still, I'm so happy it's springtime.
It is. The birds are chirping.
Oh, yeah, they're going nuts here.
Starting
all six of them that remain.
The 50% that haven't been wiped out due to human intervention. Starting out with former State Department leader Madeleine Albright,
Secretary of State, first female Secretary of State in U.S. history, which is kind of remarkable after 220 some years. Of course, Condoleezza Rice was the second. So that's not exactly a great tradition. She's probably best remembered, at least in progressive circles, for her comment that sanctions on Iraq. She was asked if the very high death toll of children was half a million, yeah, were estimated to have died from starvation or disease or lack of medication. And her response is, well, we think the price is worth it, which is, you know, basically an endorsement of genocide. She also has a connection to Seattle, of course, because she was famously trapped in her hotel room by protesters during the WTO protests in 1999. And she reportedly was livid over that fact. Too bad. So, anyway, she has passed. The drummer for Foo Fighters also passed yesterday. That was sad to see. So, that's our obit section for this week.
Thanks for reminding me about the WTO incident, because it was her, supposedly, as the story goes, it was her displeasure with being trapped in her hotel room that got Bill Clinton to call Paul Shell. And that was on the 30th, and the following morning was when they started just doing the kettling and the massive sweeps.
Right, and the mass arrests, too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so those were the days.
What a fun week that was, yep.
All right, moving on, Starbucks making the news this week.
Yes, now specifically the workers at Starbucks, the baristas and staff at the Starbucks on Broadway and Denny voted unanimously to unionize this week. It marks the seventh Starbucks location and the first one's company owned to unionize in the country. The first one in the Seattle area. Five of them are in Buffalo, New York, and there's also one in Mesa, Arizona. So that's exciting. Next time you need a latte, you know, feel good about going to the Starbucks. It's the northwest corner of Broadway and Denny.
Yeah, and I don't remember the quote exactly, but one of the lead organizers at that Starbucks had said something to the effect of, yeah, we realized that just being blocks away from Starbucks headquarters, we really owed it to ourselves to, you know, nice here. So
yeah, and there are several other Starbucks locations in the city they're talking about organizing as well. So we'll see.
Yep. All right, and a brief mention. I saw also this week that Amazon has been dropped as a sponsor for the 2022 Seattle Pride Parade.
Yes, I saw that.
Due to their political contributions to anti-LGBTQ elected officials.
Yeah, so. like Egan and Orion, for example. who for people who don't follow the inside baseball is actually the head of Seattle Pride. And he ran against Shama Sawant in 2019 with Amazon's support.
A lot of support.
Yeah, a lot of support. And it will be very interesting to see in 2023, which is only next year. You know, who is running on city council, since we had a significant shift toward business interests in the election last year with the election of the new mayor and Deborah Juarez becoming the city council president. And with Sarah Nelson also getting elected to replace Michael Bryan. So, it'll be interesting to see what city council does over the next year. It's still a historically progressive city council in terms of its majority. The demographics in Seattle are changing. The money at stake in Seattle politics is definitely changing. And that may be our future, unfortunately.
Actually, I think Sarah Nelson replaced Lorena Gonzalez.
Oh, you're right. She did. That was my mistake. She's at large.
She is at large and roaming the city.
Yes.
All right. So Scott Greenstone at Seattle Times reported this week that Seattle's Representative Frank Chop is trying to move $2 million from the Regional Homeless Authority to a nonprofit he co-founded.
Yeah, the $2,050,000 award in state money was allocated in last year's budget session, but went unused. The King County Regional Homeless Authority announced last week those same funds. Would be divided between Catholic Community Services and Chief Seattle Club for tiny shelters for homeless people. But CHOP instead is trying to redirect the money to the Low Income Housing Institute, which has not only did he co-found it back in the day, but he Lehi also has been controversial in recent years for taking over tiny house shelters and particularly their conflict with Nicholsville, where they basically, took over Nicholsville's, sites, the powers that be in the city, went along with it, the housing department and the city and so forth, because the housing department has never liked the idea of Shearwheel or Nicholsville having self-managed homeless encampments. They'd much rather adapt the city's preferred mode over the last 25 years or so, which is a very paternalistic mode of saying, you must have really screwed up your life in order to get here, so we need to fix it for you. Which is a very convenient way of ducking the question of the main cause of homelessness, and study after study now has shown this. There's a very strong correlation between rising rents and homelessness. Gee, go figure. There is not a supply of affordable housing in the Seattle area, as almost anybody who's listening to this can attest. Real estate, as we move on from the pandemic, has once again been rising. Rents have been rising. Home values have been rising. And no surprise that that results in people who, for instance, have lost a job or who have run into health problems or whatever it might be, not being able to afford rent. It seemed like we were making progress in getting, building public housing that would be semi-affordable into the pipeline in the last couple of years. But, that once again is being hijacked by people like Chop, who likes to pretend that he's progressive, but has really been an impediment to progressive legislation for decades in the state legislature. As we have noted in past years, he can't retire soon enough.
And Nicholsville being notable for being one of the few entities that has a democratic process as part of the people that live there. They vote on different changes.
As I said, it's self-managed, and the city hates that because it gives homeless people agency and investment in their own living quarters, and can't have that.
And meanwhile, this week, again, as part of this, you know, the city continued to do sweeps all week long.
Yep.
I saw at least, there were at least three of them, one in the Chinatown International District on Friday, and then Wednesday.
That was near 12th and Jackson, yeah.
Yeah, like 100 people. And then Wednesday.
And you know, that particular area has had informal encampments for at least a couple of years. So, you know, they sweep it. All it's going to do is make life more difficult for the homeless people, take their possessions, all the rest of that. And they'll relocate probably somewhere a couple blocks away. So it's really, you know, the city's usual whack-a-mole. And it's very unfortunate. But we've talked about that before.
And then Wednesday there was one at Pratt Park and a sweep at Gasworks Park. Those were just the ones I could easily find, you know, yesterday. So the word is that the city is not putting out ahead of time lists to notify folks.
Erica Barnett's been doing quite a bit of reporting on that. And Pratt Park, for people who aren't aware, is in the Central District and a rapidly gentrifying corner of the Central District. So, not surprising that somebody complained there.
Moving on, Shauna Sowersby at the Olympian reported this week, did a nice compilation reporting that nearly two dozen Washington lawmakers have announced that they will not be seeking re-election.
Yeah, about 20 of them, 11 Democrats, 9 Republicans, and there's a few notable ones. Tim Sheldon, who was the bane of the Democratic caucus for many years while the balance of power was very similar to Joe Manchin in Congress. You know, he was a very conservative Democrat from Shelton, Washington, and, you know, always perpetually seemingly about to jump to the Republican Party, never did, but, you know, stymied quite a bit of progressive legislation over the years. He is retiring. And then a couple notable people in the Seattle delegation, Senator Reuben Carlisle, who was first elected in 2008, is going to retire. He's going to seek opportunities in the private sector, which always seem to come to former legislators. And then Eileen Cody, former healthcare advocate, many, many years representing West Seattle in the House of Representatives. She will be retiring as well, and she will be truly missed.
Yeah, there's a few more I thought were of interest. David Frocht, who has a background with labor. He's from Seattle in the 46th District, is retiring.
Yes.
Mona Doss, who just got elected in 2018. From Kent, from the 47th.
Noel Frame.
But I believe she's, they were part of a group who are seeking election in a different office. So moving over,
right.
I think she's moving over to the Senate or trying to. And Jesse Johnson from Federal Way, the 37th District, who had sponsored key police reform legislation. And was a relative newcomer, either 2018. He might have been in one other previous electoral run, but.
Yeah. So we will start to see people running for those offices pretty soon. Of course, it's remarkable. We're only 5 months away from the August primary. So that season is coming up on us.
Yeah.
So. If for people who were going to retire or seek other office, now is the time to do it. And I'm sure we'll see more announcements in the next week or two.
Moving along, a report this week from Publicola that the UW can keep civilians who replaced campus cops.
Yeah, and this is a telling difference between UW, which is, of course, a public agency, but doesn't have the kind of labor agreement that requires, you know, negotiating with the police union for a new contract every few years. Instead, disputes go to Washington's Public Employee Relations Commission, which is sort of a mediation agency. And that agency made a decision this week that UW could replace armed officers in their residence halls with new unarmed campus safety responders, which is, you know, a nice euphemism for cop, but they will be unarmed, which, you know, seems like a nice proactive step to take. This is, of course, something that law enforcement agencies were pressured to do by a lot of advocates, especially during the 2020 protests. You know, SPD, we're still waiting. They have no contract. They have had no contract since 2017. And they have no permanent police chief either. You know, Adrian Diaz is still the acting police chief, even though he's been acting for a year now. And we haven't heard anything from the incoming Harrell administration yet about either a process for selecting a permanent police chief or a process for negotiating a new contract. The last go around with negotiating a new contract, which got thrown out by the Federal Oversight Court, that was negotiated by the Durkin administration, and it had representatives. Excuse me. It had representatives from the Citizen Police Commission in the negotiations, which was a step forward, but it still, you know, would have negated a number of reforms that City Council had passed, I believe, in 2018, that still have not been enacted because it requires approval of labor contracts. So SPD is very much stalled, and the SPD's unions, particularly the Seattle Police Officers Guild, is a major reason why. And UW was able to shortcut that process, which is, you know, some of it's a possible direction, since, of course, SPD is a public employee relations agency also, so it was covered by that, I should say. So, you know, perhaps the city could go that direction, mediation. You know, God knows they've been stymied for long enough in trying to reach a new contract.
Yeah, the University of Washington is benefits from some flexibility in how it approaches different things, because it is a state university that, in this case, it seems to have worked out for the better, but I know in plenty of situations where UW can kind of strong arm its way through, whereas other entities, other organizations, large organizations, run up against brick walls when, well, maybe brick isn't the right term, since
yeah.
Straw walls that bind other large entities within our region. So
yeah, and UW has had a number of labor disputes in past years with the SEIU 9-to-5, with graduate students' attempts to unionize. You know, the list is extensive.
Yeah, they're almost constantly battling with the different union-based groups there at the UW, which are numerous.
Yes.
So, and one of those actually is the, I'm not going to get this totally right, the resident health workers, doctors who are going through their residency. I know they are literally in negotiations right now. Well, not literally as we speak, but like this week they were in negotiations. So,
yeah, and their working conditions are just atrocious. It's like, you know, it's a physical endurance test as much as anything.
It's almost like a hazing, you know.
Yeah, very, very much like that, yes.
Which actually
you know, the one group that would have some leverage, I would love to see the football players try and unionize. That'd be hilarious.
Oh, that'd be interesting. Which seems like a reasonable segue onto talking about, speaking of healthcare, moving on to this week's pandemic news.
Yeah. Well, the pandemic is still going on. I know I say this every week, but it's true.
We could record that line ahead.
Yeah, we could. It has largely been crowded out, I think, of public consciousness and certainly out of the news by all the news around the Ukraine war. But there is a new subvariant called BA.2. Does not have a nice Greek letter name yet because it's a subvariant of Omicron. Except it is more contagious than Omicron, and it is now up to 25% of new infections in Washington State. In the last maybe 5 days, new infections in Washington State, statewide, and in King County have been creeping back up again. This follows a couple months of steady declines. So, you know, that could be a result of the subvariant. It could be a result of the state's dropping of the mask mandate and the vaccination requirement that the county dropped, so you can go into your favorite restaurant or bar without having to worry about infecting anybody else. There's a number of possibilities, but the bottom line is we are not out of the woods yet. Hopefully, as the weather warms up, people spend more time outdoors as opposed to indoors. You know, we'll start dropping the infection rate again, but we're starting to see 25-30% infection rates for the new subvariant in much of the country. It's somewhat worrisome. But Dr. Fauci said this week that he didn't think there would be a major spike, so there is that.
I'm not sure that raises my confidence level any. I had heard, like in New York City, that the numbers were getting pretty high, and then other countries like in the UK, things were rocketing upwards.
Yes, New York City analyzed its wastewater and found about 30% of the new infections were subvariants, and BA2 is now the dominant strain in several European countries, including the UK. So, and that is frequently, in the past, in this, pandemic, been a harbinger of what happens in North America, you know, 3-4 weeks later. So, here we go.
And you had said, I believe it was in the last 2 weeks, talking about how there was $15 billion that was going to be allocated towards COVID-related investments, and that got shifted around, and it looked like several things got cut off from that would have really been important for the long haul.
Yeah, the Biden administration announced initiatives for, you know, a lot of money's worth of, like, you know, home testing and things like that. And then they couldn't get funding for it through Congress. Republicans blocked it because, you know, I don't know, they think it's a hoax or something. Or, you know, there's a Democrat in the White House. So they are trying to restore funding for some of those programs, but so far it's been very piecemeal. And they haven't announced a lot of details yet.
But even like the White House secretary was acknowledged this week with getting COVID again. She had previously gotten Jen
Psaki. Yeah.
Psaki. And I mean, it's interesting that she was the person that had like mocked a reporter when they had asked about the White House and the Biden administration distributing tests. And she had, I think, replied with the line, well, what do you propose? We're just supposed to send one out to everybody for free. You know?
It sounds like a good start, yeah. And of course, Jen Psaki tested positive this week, as did Hillary Clinton. That didn't get a lot of attention, which, at least not in the non-right-wing fever swamp circuits. I'm sure there's a theory somewhere that she got it in the pizza parlor basement in D.C. From one of the babies she ate. or something. But there were several high-profile infections this week. Additionally, people in Congress. And we haven't heard a whole lot from Susan Delbonnet, who's a local rep on the northeast side of Metro Seattle, who tested positive a couple weeks ago. And I've been looking for an update on her health status and haven't seen one. Hope she's okay.
Anything else on that?
Nope, let's move along. There's plenty of national and international news this week.
Okay. Starting with Ketanji Brown Jackson's Senate hearing this week, which got a lot of press attention.
Yeah, that was definitely a feces show. A lot of the attention centered on the Republican senators' questioning of her, particularly people like Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz. And it was hard not to listen to that and contrast it with, say, Brett Kavanaugh's hearing, at which Kavanaugh could, you know, express his frustration with the line of questioning, which was pretty legitimate, I thought. But in this case, Ketanji Brown was getting all kinds of extraneous culture war kind of questions on things that have nothing to do with the law, nothing to do with how she might rule as a Supreme Court justice, but everything to do with her race and her gender. It was really kind of infuriating to listen to her being asked, how religious are you? Because, of course, she is one of only three Supreme Court justices who is not a practicing Catholic. Because Republican presidents have stacked the courts with Catholic justices who were anti-abortion. She was not particularly asked about that. She was asked about critical race theory, which is not a thing. She was asked about being soft on crime, particularly pedophiles, which is of course, the QAnon fixation, and which ignored the fact that several of President Trump's Supreme Court nominees had the exact same record on things like child pornography. But they weren't asked about it. But she was. And the list just went on and on and on. It was interminable. It was about 30 hours over 3 days of questioning like that. I will give her credit. She handles herself with poise. She was polite to senators that she really shouldn't have been polite to or should have had to be polite to. But, of course, you know, if she probably said what she was actually thinking, she would have been labeled as temperamentally unfit. She does seem to have the votes to pass. The Senate will be voting on her nomination next week, so we'll welcome her to the new high court, presumably, very soon. First African American woman ever on the Supreme Court.
All right. Well, I'll believe that when I see it. I haven't seen much out of the Senate in the last couple of years that would buoy my hopes at all on this particular vote.
Yeah, well, Joe Manchin has said he's going to vote yes. The only other one that's outstanding, of course, is Kyrsten Sinema, who is, I think, more of an attention junkie than anything else. But there's no indication she won't vote yes. And with those two, I think all the other Democratic senators have said yes, so that would get her to 50. Might not get any Republican votes at all because, as I said, she was nominated by a Democratic president, so by definition she's unfit or something. McConnell was not in a position to say, well, it's only 3 years away from a presidential election, so we can't have hearings on it yet.
All right. Well, sticking with the subject of the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah. There was this other thing this week, wasn't there? Yeah. Virginia Thomas, who has long been a walking conflict of interest. She is the spouse of Clarence Thomas, who is at this point the oldest serving Supreme Court member and also by far the most partisan Very predictable how he will vote on most issues. It turns out that Virginia Thomas was much more instrumental than we previously knew in trying to, quote-unquote, stop the steal. And in attending the January 6th rally, although she says she was not at the Capitol that day, she left before President Trump spoke. But she had been texting really since the election in early November with Mark Meadows, who was then Trump's chief of staff, strategizing on ways to try and overturn the election results and make sure Trump could stay in power. In other words, she was an active conspirator in the process to overthrow the duly elected U.S. government. And she is the spouse of a Supreme Court member who can reasonably expect it to have to rule on such things if they make it through the courts that far. And in fact, Thomas has had a couple of rulings, including most recently that Trump had to give over his records, communications from January 6th. And that, unfortunately, was an 8-1 vote. Guess who the one no vote was? It was Clarence Thomas. So there's a lot of talk about potentially impeaching Thomas, which is the only way you can remove a Supreme Court member. They are their lifetime appointments, and they are not bound by any code of ethics. That's interesting, because, of course, it's the highest court in the land, so who would enforce it? So there's no conflict of interest structure the way there is for other federal judicial positions. And, you know, Thomas and his wife have been abusing this for many, many years. Ginny Thomas is a very well-connected Republican operative who, you know, owes her position in the fact that people like Mark Meadows will give out their phone numbers to her and take her texts and take her phone calls and all the rest of that, to the fact that she is a wife of a Supreme Court justice. Some people are talking about impeachment. Others want either Ginny or Clarence or both to come testify before a congressional committee. I'm not sure that any of that is going to happen. At minimum, Thomas should be recusing himself from anything to do with January 6th or the 2020 election. But he has not done that so far, and I don't think the odds are very good that he will, because it's okay if you're a Republican. It's staggeringly corrupt and very dangerous. But, yeah, that's where we are.
And if there were impeachment proceedings, that would come from Congress, correct?
That would come from Congress. But, you know, again, you need 2/3 vote to convict. And as we saw with Donald Trump twice, you can't get that unless, you know, Democrats hold 2/3 of the seats, which is not going to happen anytime soon.
Right. All right. So don't hold your breath.
Yep.
All right.
Oh, and speaking of not holding your breath, we also had a major development this week in the Manhattan DA's potential prosecution of Donald Trump personally and the Trump Organization for basically tax fraud, for overvaluing and undervaluing various properties. It appears that that prosecution is not going to go forward. We had two very senior prosecutors who'd been working on that prosecution quit abruptly. And their resignation letter from last month was leaked to, I believe it was the Washington Post, in which they said that they believe that Donald Trump was guilty of numerous criminal charges. And they were very frustrated that the new Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, has decided not to go forward with that prosecution. The Bragg's office is not commenting on this, but he replaced Cy Vance about last fall after the 2021 election. So That is one prosecution successfully stalled by Team Trump, and we've got several others that are still in play. We've got a civil case from the state of New York, the attorney general there. We've still got the Fulton County, Georgia investigation, which we haven't heard anything about in a long time. But that was the one where Trump, who is actually in Georgia today, to campaign against, among others, the incumbent governor and secretary of state because they wouldn't find him the votes he needed to take that state. So that grand jury is still impaneled, as far as anybody knows. The Trump crime family continues to skate. It's remarkable. Amazing what being rich can buy you in the justice system in the United States.
Or the appearance of being rich.
Well, that too, yes.
I mean, it looks like it's all, a lot of it's smoke and mirrors from everything I've seen, but.
That is true.
Moving on.
And one wonders what economic impact is the Trump organization is having from the fact that they can't launder ill-begotten Russian mob money anymore.
Well, I guess you just have to shop that to another entity and who'll be taking a higher percentage.
Pretty much, yep.
All right. NPR reported this week that Idaho prepares to ban most abortions in the state as governor signs a Texas-style law.
Yeah, SB 8 in Texas has survived all its court challenges somehow. As soon as that happened, there have been a number of other states whose legislators have been trying to go forward with similar laws. The first one to get it through the process, is apparently our neighbors in Idaho. It's a very similar provisions to the Texas law. The people who impregnated the woman in question or members of their family could sue abortion providers for tens of thousands of dollars in damages. That has been signed now by Governor Brad Little on Wednesday. The law bans most abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy when most women don't even know they're pregnant yet. Is modeled after the Texas law. So, I'm sure they'll be rearing up for lots of new business in the clinics in Spokane and Missoula. But very, very sad to see other states going in that direction. And a reminder, the Supreme Court, yes, that Supreme Court, the one we're just talking about, is due to rule probably in about 3 months on the Mississippi abortion ban that would specifically overturn Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade is still on the books as a precedent in the United States, even though you've got the Republican-controlled states now that are ignoring it. It will be an interesting Supreme Court term, but I would expect that will be overturned since there's a conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court now, and that I would think could not help but have an impact on the midterms because people are going to be very, very angry when that happens, as they should be.
Okay, Utah.
Speaking of culture wars and solving problems that don't really exist, Republican legislators in Utah overruled the governor's veto this week to push through a ban on transgender youth athletes playing on girls' teams. Now, I'm glad that Utah has solved all its other problems so that it can move forward on this pressing issue. 11 other states have had similar laws amid a nationwide culture war push on that. And I'm sure that they've already taken care of critical race theory. So, God help you if you are a transgender youth athlete of color. You know, you can't learn about your history either, I guess. So it's all ridiculousness and a way to distract from the fact that under Republican rule, we had a pandemic grow out of control. We basically would have waved a white flag when Russia invaded Ukraine and so forth. So, somewhat depressing.
Oh, during, talked about the pandemic earlier, obviously. Didn't we reach 1 million deaths this week in the United States?
It depends who's counting. The official toll is not there yet, but it will be next week, I'm sure. We're getting there. And the official toll is likely much higher than that because both deaths and infections have systematically been undercounted, especially in red states these days.
And as you reported on previous episodes of this show, the federal government had changed its expectations and requirements for the states reporting on.
Well, no, not the states, the actual hospitals. Okay. They were supposed to be reporting to the CDC. The beginning of the year, that was quietly dropped. So they have to report to states, and a number of states now are not doing daily updates. They're doing updates, you know, 2-3 times a week or every other day or something like that. Washington State is one of those states that's gone to 3 times a week, as has the county. So that's very frustrating because it's harder to get an accurate day-to-day snapshot of what the direction the pandemic is going in when the state has somewhat unilaterally decided that the pandemic is over. Now, to be fair, I'm sure that the people in the various county and state health departments are just exhausted after 2 years of this. But still, So it's a little harder to tell. Basically, the 7-day average is the best snapshot now. So,
yeah, no doubt that those people that are still working in healthcare have got to be completely exhausted and demoralized.
Yeah, and a lot of people, of course, have bowed out because of the threats coming from the loony right. You know, why you would threaten the life of a public health official for doing their job is beyond me. But I guess they're part of the massive conspiracy to implant Bill Gates microchips in all of us. Oh, one other item I meant while we're on vaccines is that it looks like next week the FDA is going to consider whether all adults over the age of 50 should be getting COVID booster shots, a fourth booster shot. Now, the third booster shot has had relatively few people get it. It's only been around 30%, I think, nationally. But a fourth booster shot, particularly for people who are medically vulnerable, has been showing to have good results. So that is and people who are immunocompromised or immunosuppressed already have gotten the FDA clearance to get those fourth shots. But this would extend to all adults over the age of 50.
Briefly, last Saturday there was a gunfight at a car show, I believe.
Yes, it was actually Sunday. It was a car show in rural Arkansas, a town called Dumas, Arkansas, southeast of Little Rock. And 24 people were injured. One was killed. Two of the injured were children. You know, again, you would not have 24 people injured in a knife fight. Or in anything other than, automatic or semi-automatic weapons. It really is the guns that are the problem because there's no way you could, impact that many people, without, an automatic magazine. And this was supposed to be a, you know, small town celebratory event, the kind that happened every spring and summer. But this one was tragic. And that again speaks to the gun problem in this country.
Well, Moving on then to international and starting with Ukraine.
Yeah, well, there is a war going on in Ukraine. You may have noticed this by the blaring headlines day after day after day. We passed the 1 month mark for the invasion, I believe on Thursday. And there's some pretty clear trends at this point. The obvious one is that Ukraine's defending itself much better than was expected, certainly much better than Russia was expecting. And we got an announcement from a high-ranking general in Russia yesterday that suggested, and, you know, it's hard to take anything as gospel truth when it's coming from the Russian government, but this is what he said, that Russian troops were going to fall back from their attempt to take over the entire country, and they were going to focus on the eastern two provinces in Ukraine. Now, a couple things about that. Number one, the decision is really being made for them because Ukraine also started a counteroffensive this week that has been pushing the Russians back, particularly around the city of Kiev, the capital. Secondly, this whole crisis was started off, you'll remember, in late February when Putin declared he would recognize the two breakaway provinces in the east of Ukraine as independent republics. Now, this is a little sleight of hand because those two quote-unquote republics, provinces, were not fully controlled by Russian separatists. They were only controlled by about a third of the territory of those provinces. So when they say they're going to fall back to controlling those particular provinces, it means that they're probably setting themselves up to negotiate having Russian proxy governments control those provinces. Even though, recent polling in Ukraine, although God knows how many of those people still live there, showed that about 90% wanted to stay in Ukraine. They did not want to be under control of Russia. Speaking of refugees, we now have about 10 million people who have been displaced within Ukraine, which is a staggering humanitarian crisis. 6.5 million of those have been within the country, and 3.5 million have fled to neighboring countries, particularly Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania. Joe Biden is in Poland today. He's supposed to give a major speech, which is expected to announce further ramping up of NATO's defenses in Eastern Europe, as well as more military aid to Ukrainian forces. And we'll see how that is that is received. It could be Biden's I'm a Berliner moment, which is a very old historical reference to 1961 when John F. Kennedy traveled to the Berlin Wall. What else? The quote unquote peace talks seem to have broken down. There were no new sessions this week in them. And part of the Ukrainian forces pushing back is that there are now conflicting reports over who controls the critical port city of Kherson, that's at the mouth of the Dnieper River on the Black Sea. And the Dnieper River pretty much divides Ukraine in half. It's the main marine highway up and down Ukraine. It goes through Kiev, it goes through Zaporozhye, it goes through Kherson. Kherson was the first major Ukrainian city to fall to Russian forces early this month, but it now appears that Ukraine may have retaken that city. We've also been getting reports in the last day or so about Ukraine using white phosphorus weapons. Those weapons are banned under the Geneva Conventions. They literally burn through to the bone of any human being they come in contact with. People may remember, folks with long memories may remember, that the United States was credibly accused of using similar weapons in Fallujah in Iraq in 2004. So This is something that the U.S. military is familiar with. So when they say they think this is what happens, then they have some credibility on that issue. So that's sort of the state of play slightly over 1 month into this conflict, and hopefully it will end soon because Russia continues to bombard Ukrainian cities. City of Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine, the city of Kharkiv in northeastern Ukraine are just destroyed. I mean, there's literally very few buildings left that are standing, that are not burned out. And, you know, vast numbers of people have been displaced from their homes because the Russians have been clearly targeting residential areas and civilian areas. And the United States and both Biden and the State Department made a formal determination this week that they believe Russia is guilty of war crimes. Not that the United States has ever been concerned about committing war crimes, but, you know, it doesn't make it any better when another country is doing it. You know, two wrongs don't make a right. Or in the case of the United States, several decades worth of wrongs.
Yeah, or even a couple hundred years.
Well, there is that.
But it does emphasize the insanity of citizens worldwide allowing their governments to keep investing in just vastly insane amounts of weaponry that inevitably is going to be used sooner or later.
Yes, it is. And I mean, that's what it's made for, to be used. That way it can be replaced and the arms manufacturers can make more money, which is really what the bottom line is. And, you know, a historical fact, between World War I and World War II is when the big shift happened between armies targeting armies and armies targeting civilians. In World War I, a.k.a. the Great War, 90% of the casualties were people in uniform. World War II, I mean, we saw the firebombing of Dresden. We saw the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, we the 90% of the casualties were civilian. And it has continued to accelerate in that direction ever since. So now in modern wars, you know, almost all of the casualties are civilian. And we're seeing that in Ukraine as well. Which is very, very unfortunate. And a lot of new technology that we haven't seen in previous wars, particularly drone warfare, which, you know, a lot of those kamikaze drones who don't even have a human controlling it from a distance, they just program it with a destination and hit send. We saw a final determination that about 300 people died in that bomb shelter underneath a theater in Mariupol. That report, that attack about a week ago, there was a big sign in Russian on both sides of the building saying children. In other words, there are children in here. And it didn't matter, and it probably didn't matter because there was no human controlling that drone or that missile. It was just, you know, programmed for that destination, a GPS coordinate, and hit send. And it's very antiseptic and not a good development, it seems to me.
All right. Well, continuing along the line of uplifting stories.
Yeah.
Damian Carrington at The Guardian reports that microplastic pollution has been detected in human blood for the first time.
Yeah, Dutch scientists finding those tiny particles in almost 80% of the people tested. Now, that's not a very large sample size. It was only 17 of 22. But it still beats one because there was no precedent for finding those kind of particles in human bloodstreams. The discovery shows that the particles can travel around the body and can lodge in organs, for instance, the liver or kidney. The impact on health is as yet unknown. They'll need to do more studies to figure that out. But it can't be good, right? Researchers are concerned that microplastics cause damage to human cells in the laboratory, and air pollution particles are already widely known to enter the body and to cause millions of early deaths per year worldwide. So this is something, microplastics, I would think, don't decay any faster than regular plastics do. In other words, they'll last a lot longer than your body will. This is yet another way that humans are experimenting on themselves in real time, and the results can't be good. And then there's the massive experiment known as climate change. We had another major development in that this week, a huge ice shelf in Antarctica. It's about 460 square miles, disintegrated in mid-March. Now, this was due to temperatures in Antarctica, in East Antarctica specifically, during that period, being up to 40 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. Mind you, that meant that, you know, it was like, you know, minus 10 instead of minus 50, but it's still, you know, bizarrely warm. And, like, nothing shattered all previous records. Scientists were alarmed by this. One of the results of that heat wave, or less cold wave, I guess, is that another major ice shelf in Antarctica disintegrated. And as a reminder, when ice shelves in Antarctica disintegrate, that is one of the main causes of rising sea levels, because frozen fresh water, which is what an ice shelf is, takes up more space than liquid water does. So the sea level winds up rising. So you can credit the you can credit the developments this week for in 20 years once Miami goes underwater.
Yeah. But developments that have been taking place basically since over the last 100 years.
And have been recognized for the last 30 years by scientists, but there's just not been the political will to wean ourselves from fossil fuels.
Well, there are some indications that it was recognized by some scientists as back as early in the early 1900s. So,
yeah. And I should mention also, one of the developments around the Ukraine war is that Biden is expected also to announce today assistance for Germany and other Western European countries in weaning themselves from Russian fossil fuel, but it's by exporting natural gas from America, which doesn't really seem to solve that issue.
No, that doesn't seem like a real good strategy. Although I'm sure there's certain economic interests that are pleased with that development. So,
yeah, hey, at least we're not exporting coal.
Well, as long as people can make a buck off of Earth's final days, you know, I think that gives everyone a reason to smile.
Yeah, sure. The fossil fuel extraction companies were insanely profitable in the first quarter. They'll be insanely profitable in the second quarter. They'll have even greater profits in the third quarter. And oops, civilization as we know it ends in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
That's pretty much how it'll go.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that happy note,
I am nothing but a bundle of cheer this week.
As you are every week.
I did say happy spring at the beginning.
I think you weaved it in there. I think you were being sarcastic, though.
No, I was not being sarcastic. I love hearing the birds sing. I love watching the trees bud. It's all good. It reminds me that life on Earth will survive in some form long after we do.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll plan on talking to you same time next week.
Yes, assuming we're all still here.